I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Not too many years ago, our nation's capital was considered unsafe, unappealing, and generally unlivable. But today, everywhere you look, there are cranes in the air, and housing prices have soared as redevelopment and new building have made the district a very attractive market. Today, we'll talk about Washington, D.C. as a place to live and do business with experts who are two of its major change agents. John Hill is CEO of Federal City Council in Washington, D.C. His job is to bring business and professional talent to the district's major issues. Eric Bolog is managing partner of Tenacity Group, a collection of companies reinventing affordable housing in the district. Our subject is Washington, D.C., not as politics, but as home, today on Smart City, right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. John Hill is CEO of the Federal City Council in Washington, D.C. Federal City Council works to enhance the nation's capital by focusing the creative and administrative talents of Washington's business and professional leaders on major problems and opportunities that are facing the city. John, D.C.'s last mayor, Tony Williams, made it one of his goals to increase the population of the district. It didn't happen, but it's hard to travel around the district and not see cranes everywhere. What's going on there?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, there was an increase in the population in the district. It didn't increase, I think, as much as the mayor may have wanted it to, but there's clearly a lot more people who are moving in, living in the downtown area. There's a lot more housing downtown. There's even more housing that's being constructed in the neighborhoods as well. So I do think that there's generally some people who are very interested in moving into the city. I think the one issue that the city really needs to address in order to get a lot more people to move in, especially in the middle class, would be education. And so I think that's a principal impediment to having people live in the city, especially people with school-age children.
Is Federal City Council involved in the school issue?
Yes, very much so. I mean, the Federal City Council has been involved for a number of years in bringing attention to this issue, working directly with other organizations in the city, particularly the government as well as the school system, to try to bring a spotlight on the issues of education and also on some of the solutions to the education problem.
Well, you're certainly not by yourself. Good schools are a challenge for most urban centers, and so you're no exception. Are you seeing any progress?
You know, we are seeing some progress in small areas. Unfortunately, it's slow right now, and there really needs to be an increased sense of urgency. You know, when you think about the amount of time that you have to educate children, and you know, losing a year or losing 2 years while people are waiting for reforms to occur is just not acceptable with someone's life. So it's a very, very serious issue here in the nation's capital. And also, though, you know, when you look at the numbers of people that we're dealing with here, we now have 55,000 students that are in public schools. So it makes it really one of the smallest public school systems of a major urban area. Many of the parents have actually opted for private school and charter school. So the total number of school children, it's about 75,000, actually approaching 80,000, but only 55,000 of those are actually in public schools right now.
And what has been your role in school change, school improvement there?
I was executive director of the control board during the time when the president had appointed a control board, which was authorized by Congress, to really oversee the finances of the nation's capital. And it ended up managing a number of the agencies. One of the ones that we did take over was schools. And at that time, we looked around the country for various models that we could bring to the city. The one model that we wanted to bring to the city was Chicago's model, where the mayor played a major role in school reform and also a major role in conjunction with the business community in bringing about solutions to education in the city. The only problem at the time was that the mayor of the District of Columbia was someone that the Congress was actually taking agencies away from, so we couldn't very well give the school system to him. But we would have done that. And now, with the mayor's current plan, there's a real opportunity for the mayor to take over responsibility for the schools, hire a superintendent or chancellor that would report directly to him, and then be able to really streamline some of the reforms that have to occur in order for education to improve in the city. So we're the Federal City Council are working to support that effort in any way that we possibly can.
Why do you think mayoral takeover of schools is a good idea?
Well, I think in this situation, and I'm not so sure that it's the right answer in every situation, but clearly in this situation where you have so many different organizations involved in the governance, I mean, we have the federal government, clearly, that's involved in the governance. We have the Congress that actually has responsibility for the district's budget. We have the Council of the District of Columbia. We have the school board, and we have the superintendent. So it really is a structure that that makes it hard to pinpoint responsibility and accountability. With the mayor having direct control over the school system, he's able to really provide through a chancellor the leadership that needs to occur, and then also align the operations of government across the entire government to help with these reforms. And so we believe that the mayor having responsibility for the school system really will help to improve not only the alignment of responsibility, but will actually help to improve the type of leadership that we can attract to the nation's capital to run our schools.
Setting aside for a minute the challenges of urban schools, and again, you're not alone in that, so every major city faces that challenge. Let's come back and talk about all those cranes around the District of Columbia, which are so impressive. I mean, I can remember not too many years ago in Washington, once you got beyond the mall and the museums and so forth, Washington was a pretty sleepy place. And now, obviously, people want to move there. There's a great street life, lots of restaurants, cafes. Your job growth has been tremendous, not only in the district, but also certainly in the region, which feeds a strong city. So tell me, what has been the key to D.C.'s turnaround?
Well, I think there are a number of issues that I think that, when addressed, actually had a huge impact on the district's turnaround. Clearly, let's start with Mayor Williams, who used to be the CFO for the district during the control board era, where the city had really no ability to borrow money on its own. Its bonds were junk bonds. It had a cumulative deficit that was astronomical. And now you have a city that has a surplus, a sizable surplus, probably one of the largest surpluses of any municipal government in the country, and has a wonderful rating on its bonds, and so is able to borrow. Also has government really return to control of major local decisions, and has the confidence of Capitol Hill for it to operate fairly independently. So I think that's created an environment of a fiscal solvency, a fiscal strength that has attracted investment, and then also has made the government in a position of supporting the type of investment that could cause increases in revenue-generating activities. So I think that's one thing. The other issue is, over the last 8 years, I guess it was, we had really one of the best police chiefs in the country, Chief Ramsey, who came in also during the control board era, who arguably anyone that you talk to in the police community would say that he is one of the very best police chiefs in the country. He reduced crime significantly in the city over the last 8 years. And so when you've improved the economics of being here, when you've improved that when you have a reduction of the fear of crime and have an actual reduction in crime itself, I think those were two really, really strong motivators for investment and growth in the city. The other thing that's happening, I think, nationally, and this is happening in a lot of cities, you know, people are tired of commuting. I mean, people are really tired of getting in their cars and spending upwards of 4 to 6 hours going to and from work. And so I think that we have a number of people who are now interested in buying condos, coming back into the city, and working downtown where a lot of the jobs are, whereas a lot of these people were actually commuting long distances in order to have that larger house in the suburbs and so forth. And with additional people, with economic solvency, with a reduction in the fear of crime, you get new restaurants, you get new investment, you get a new life in the city. You know, the other thing that isn't really talked about a lot, I'm also on the board of the Shakespeare Theater. I'm treasurer of the Shakespeare Theater. And the resurgence in this city of the arts, and both the performing arts, the visual arts, and so forth, has made this city a place where people actually come for artistic expression. And right now we're in the middle of a six-month-long citywide Shakespeare Festival, where almost all of the arts institutions and theaters in this city, you know, being led by the Shakespeare Theater in Washington, have dedicated this entire month to showcasing works of Shakespeare. And so we have people who are coming from all over the country to see these types of, you know, these types of events and these types of programs. And so it's really, I think, all of the above that have made Washington a very, very different place than it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is John Hill. He is CEO of the Federal City Council in Washington, D.C. When you think about the parts of the district that have experienced the greatest change, which parts would those be?
Well, I mean, clearly the downtown has just changed drastically. It's changed drastically in terms of the number of people who are now living downtown, and also the number of restaurants, the number of theaters, and so forth. When you look at our neighborhoods, you can even see tremendous growth in the neighborhoods. You see old projects or subsistence housing that's being torn down, and in its place, affordable housing, townhouses, and other types of garden housing is being created in order to provide housing for people who were there, but also create more mixed-income neighborhoods. In our neighborhoods, you see a lot more stores that are opening up. You see grocery stores, you see restaurants, and so forth. So I think there aren't many parts of the city that have not been affected by this renaissance. You can also see it in the price of housing and the price of land in general across the entire city.
You connect top business and professional leaders to the affairs, the civic work, and the public work of D.C. What are the issues that they are most drawn to today?
Well, I tell you, one of the issues that they're most drawn to today, as we talked a little bit earlier, is education. Clearly, if I had to put one at the top of the list, I would say that is probably the number one issue for the people who are involved in the Federal City Council. Also, transportation. Having a stable source of funding for our metro system, which is now over 30 years old and in need of a tremendous amount of capital investment in order to really keep that system running well, and that affects the entire region. Helping the police chief to be successful. We also sponsor the D.C. Police Fund, which actually helps to implement certain activities that the police chief feels are unnecessary to help reduce crime and reduce the fear of crime. in terms of transportation specifically, trying to open up E Street, which, if you remember, around the time of 9/11, the streets that are around the White House, which are key east-west avenues for commerce in this city, were closed. Pennsylvania Avenue was closed north of the White House, and E Street was closed south of the White House. And so trying to get E Street open in a way that could still protect the security of the president's residence, but also allow for commerce to continue with the east-west flow of traffic in the city. We're working on affordable housing and neighborhood development. So all of those issues are really key for improving the quality of life for our citizens, as well as I chair the library board here in Washington as well, and we're in the middle of a huge renaissance of our library system. We just recently hired Jenny Cooper, who was the library director in Brooklyn, and she is helping us in conjunction with the mayor and the council to really bring a world-class library system here to the nation's capital.
And when business and professional leaders get involved with these civic concerns, how do they do it? How are they most likely to do it? Give money, give time? If they're giving time, what are they doing?
You know, I think it's all of the above. I think it is certainly giving money. When it's clear that the money will be and can be used for the purposes intended. Business really knows what business does best. Business isn't specifically involved in deciding, let's say with education, what the appropriate curriculum would be for the schools. But businesses know how to build things, businesses know how to procure things, and businesses know how to manage a payroll personnel system. So those major business processes, we have people who every day will work with their counterparts in these various agencies and provide them the expertise that they have. So when they get involved, that's what they do. When they get involved, they help to rebuild our schools. When business gets involved, it helps to plan for how school renovation is going to take place, because I think Washington, D.C. has some of the best developers in the country, and you can certainly see that by our skyline. And I think when those developers are willing to get involved with our various institutions that need their expertise, everybody wins.
Have you seen the phenomenon, John, as we have, with the globalization of business, with competition increasing? It seems that it is more difficult now than ever to get businesses directly engaged in community. I mean, it's one of the reasons they hire guys like you and join organizations like yours, because they professionalized civic involvement, in the same way that they professionalize many things. I'm just curious if you find it increasingly difficult to get their time and attention.
You know, it's interesting. I would have thought that before I came to this position. And the Federal City Council, we have a number of multinational corporations that aren't even headquartered here, that have offices here because this is the seat of our national government. And they, too, have wanted to get involved in Washington, D.C. because it is the nation's capital, and they participate very actively in what's going on in the city. So I haven't seen the difficulty in getting those multinational corporations involved, I guess probably because it is Washington, D.C., and it is a special place and should probably be I think one of the best run and one of the best invested in cities in our country. And so I think for that national pride, as well as the civic pride, that we attract both local and national businesses to our organization.
Have there been occasions when your members wanted to get involved in an issue and you discouraged them?
I think it's more a matter of really establishing the ground rules up front. We know that government has to be ready to receive the help that business provides. And we also know that business leaders demand results. And if government isn't ready to receive that help in a way that business can be supportive, then you run the risk of actually reinforcing some of the negative stereotypes about business involvement in government and about government to some business leaders. And so we want to make sure that the conditions are at least as optimal as possible so that there can be a result over a period of time. It doesn't have to be tomorrow. It doesn't have to be next year. But there has to be movement toward a positive result in order for businesses to really feel that their investment of time and money is worthwhile. Mm-hmm. And once you start that cycle of investment and results, I believe you then get more people involved, more people interested. If you have investment and no result, then I think it's harder to get someone to come to the table the next time. Mm-hmm. So that's why we're very careful about the projects that we do, and we want to make sure that both parties to the project are ready.
Do you think there are any risks or cautions for the public in terms of business involvement?
Well, I think, and Washington is no different probably than other organizations, I mean, and other cities. There are some times when I think that citizens believe that the only reason that business is getting involved is because their profits at the end of the transaction or at the end of their involvement. And the one thing that I've seen in Washington D.C., which is maybe unique from other cities, we have a border trade that is a regional business organization. We also have a chamber of commerce that is a local D.C. business organization. And some of the same business leaders that belong to those organizations and fight very hard to make it easier to do business in the city come to the Federal City Council and take off those business hats and just want to give back. And so I think that it's important for the public to realize that there are people out there at very high levels in these organizations, at the CEO levels and just below that, because that's who our members are, who really do want to give back and aren't, at least in that particular aspect, thinking about what the return is going to be. Everybody knows that a stronger D.C., a stronger economy here, people who are have a higher standard of living, everybody benefits from that.
One of the projects you've been working on for the district is the National Music Center and Museum. Tell me about it.
Yeah, the National Music Center and Museum is a project of the Federal City Council. It really got stalled for a while, and it still is a bit stalled in terms of a permanent location. However, we have recently entered into an agreement with the city to actually bring some of the programs of the National Music Center to the Carnegie Library, which is a beautiful building in the center of the city that used to house the Central Library. And so we felt that it would be important for us to demonstrate the power of music, the power of music programs in helping to improve the lives and the well-being of children and residents of the nation's capital, to get the kind of support from the city that we might need to build a larger national music center. So that's the tack that we're taking now.
John, it was good talking with you.
It was great talking to you, too.
John Hill is CEO of Federal City Council in Washington, D.C. It's time now to get the latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development from PlanEdison.com. Here now is Nate Berg.
The city of Philadelphia has been trying hard to revive its waterfront in recent years, but there's always been something in the way. Interstate 95 is literally a hurdle, with a portion running directly along the Delaware Riverfront, cutting it off from the rest of the city. A recent gathering of planners, designers, and architects spent 3 days brainstorming ways to develop the waterfront and keep the interstate, according to an article in the Philadelphia Inquirer. In the end, their proposal is basically for a Philadelphia version of Boston's Big Dig, the massive and lengthy project to build platforms over the city's freeways. Many hope capping I-95 will improve access to the soon-to-be-redeveloped riverfront. But basing Philadelphia's project on Boston's problem-stricken Big Dig is giving many locals a reason to be skeptical. And while those officials in Philadelphia are looking for ways to bring people to the city core, census data have revealed that urban areas may not be where people want to be. Many demographers are now estimating that the majority of the world's people now live in urban areas, but a new real estate trend shows that many people are moving back to the countryside. From Chicago to New York to Los Angeles, census figures show that 18 out of the 25 largest metropolitan areas in the United States experienced a net out-migration. According to an article in ABC News, many real estate experts are saying the trend is a result of more investors looking for new land to buy. Others attribute the urban exodus to a new ease of living afforded by the internet age, which allows rural residents to connect to urban workplaces and to access many of the goods and services not readily available in rural settings. Meanwhile, in hopes of bringing more people out to one of the country's most picturesque sites, developers in Arizona have begun construction on a controversial addition to the Grand Canyon. A horseshoe-shaped walkway now hangs 70 feet out over the south rim of the canyon and will be open to tourists by the end of the month, according to the Arizona Republic. Dubbed the Grand Canyon Skywalk, this new 1-million-pound steel walkway offers tourists the opportunity to walk on top of cleared glass jutting out into the canyon's void and looking straight down more than 4,000 feet. Many environmentalists and conservationists are concerned about what they see as a gimmicky and incompatible use of space in the national park. But for members of the Hualapai Nation, developers of the Skywalk, the new tourist attraction and the anticipated high visitation are expected to greatly improve their quality of life. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. After a short break, we'll find out how Washington, D.C. is solving its affordable housing shortage with the help of Tenacity Group. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Eric Bolog is managing partner of Tenacity Group, a Bethesda, Maryland-based vertically integrated real estate conglomerate that specializes in turning apartment dwellers into homeowners. In 2003, he was named by Legal Times as a leading lawyer in litigation. Eric, the lack of affordable housing is a serious concern in hot markets, but Tenacity Group operates in some of the nation's hottest real estate markets, providing, in effect, affordable condos. How do you do that?
What we have done is combine 8 different companies for a vertically integrated group of companies with the mission statement of creating first-time or home ownership opportunities, really for workforce housing individuals, lower-income individuals. The price point that we're looking for end sales are somewhere between $150,000 and $350,000, and that to us has been a very safe and comfortable price area. A lot of developers over the last 5 or 6 years that have specialties in condominiums or multifamily housing made the conscious decision that you go through the same brain damage for lower cost units as you do for higher cost units, so we might as well go and try to max out and do as much density at the higher levels as possible. Tenacity Group, which is my company, which stands for Tenant City, went the exact opposite direction. What we made a decision to do long ago, 15 years ago, was to really try to go into cities that have certain type of statutes or hooks which give tenants the rights to purchase their buildings when the owners of those buildings are going to sell them. What ultimately ends up happening is, I'll give you an example, in the District of Columbia, there's something called a TOPA, or Tenant Opportunity to Purchase Act, which allows a tenant to purchase, not a tenant, but a tenant association, to purchase their building whenever the owner has entered into a contract to sell that building to a third party. It is a mandatory right of first refusal that the tenants get. It is a seat at the table for the tenants. So if you look at an example where building owner A is going to sell it to buyer B for $20 million, as soon as that contract is executed, building owner A has the absolute obligation to go to the tenants, give them notice, and say, you will now have the right to purchase this building for $20 million. Well, typically the tenants are missing two things, $20 million and the knowledge of how to take their rental building and then ultimately convert it into a condominium, do the necessary renovations, both on the common area renovations, the roofs, the systems, the windows, things like that, as well as interior renovations in their own units. And what we do is we enter into development agreements with those tenant groups, whereby the tenants are represented by counsel. We actually give the tenants money to go hire whatever lawyer they want to negotiate a development agreement with us, which spells out everything that we as a developer are required to do and what financial terms the tenants that live there at the time are going to be able to purchase their units for. And in many instances, we've also provided the financing for the tenants to purchase their units, sometimes as low as 6% 30-year fixed money, regardless of the tenant's credit score. What we get out of this is we get the right to go and develop the building. We sell the tenants their units at cost, which is typically 55% or so of the market value. And then we will sell the balance of the units, whichever units the tenants don't purchase, to the marketplace.
What percent of the units have to be available to the market at market rates to make your deal work?
Well, the Tenacity Group really does live by the adage of doing good by doing right, and we really do try to do that. And what we know is that the biggest question that gets asked of us is always, well, how do you all make your money? It sounds like it's a very altruistic endeavor that you're involved in, but what's in it for you all? And the answer to that is very simple. We, through the eight different companies, have market fees that are charged to each of the deals. And so there's fees that are being earned, if you will, on the left side of the ledger, and then we make the profit off the market units. And so in most buildings, we could very easily go ahead and we can go market the buildings, and we can make our money vis-a-vis the fees alone and have a profit. So if 100% of the tenants purchase their units, we would still be able to do it, and it would still be cost effective. Now, that's not what typically happens. What typically happens is you have three types of solutions. You'll have the tenant that wants to purchase their unit and become an owner, which is what we recommend. You have the tenants that don't want to own, and the tenants that don't want to own don't own. And then you have the third, which are taking buyouts. And so we will offer a certain amount of money for those tenants that don't want to own and they don't want to rent. They don't want to be living in a construction zone. They'll move on, and they'll take typically somewhere between $10,000 and $20,000, and they'll move on and go to another rental unit in the city in which we're doing the work.
I want to stick with your business model for a minute. You say that you are providing financing for people who may not have the credit to justify it. How do you do that?
Well, the way in which we can make the money in that component of it, and remember, all eight components don't have to be making positive fees for it to work. And we've really never seen a building in which more than 50% of the tenants that live there wanted to purchase. And so historically, it has never happened with the 75 or 80 completed condominium projects that we've worked on, where I think much more than 50% of the then existing tenant base chose to purchase. So we've never been in a situation where, you know, you're only making it on the fees. But we know this. We know when we get involved in a building that might be 100% leased, the chance does exist, the scenario that we can only make our money on the fee side. And so we price that in. But again, it's all market rate. For instance, the fees that our construction company charging are just what the market would bear, and each and every component of all of the 8 vertically integrated companies are all market charges, and so we're not charging twice as much for the conversion or charging twice as much for them on the mortgage side or on the title side or on the closing or any of that kind of stuff. It's just not what we do. There are deals in which we have guaranteed financing, 30-year, 6% money to tenant groups that have negotiated for that in the development agreement. And those loans typically are very safe loans for our mortgage company because we know that the tenant is buying their unit at typically 50 to 55% of the market value. So we know that there's 45 to 50% of equity in the unit. And so if the tenant found themselves in with the inability to pay their mortgage, two things would happen. We would go as a company to those tenants to try to help those tenants work it out, to try to help them get their credit cleaned up so that they could go and get a second, mortgage, but a replacement mortgage on the property. Well, alternatively, our Tenacity Sales Group would go and see these people and assist these people in selling the unit. That way, the unit's not foreclosed on, and when it's sold, the tenant, not the developer, makes that 45% equity on the sale. And so it's our goal to try to really give the people that are purchasing these units the full benefit of the home ownership opportunity. And in some cases, if they're short-lived, it's at least they are the ones that have benefited from the equity that we were able to generate by the work that we did in the building.
Let's back up. Describe a typical project for me.
Well, you know, uniquely, Carol, you've actually been with us to some of our projects, and so I can describe one of them that we brought you to, which was 3513th Street in D.C., which was a building that was actually being condemned, and the landlord that owned it was actually going to be sentenced to prison for the way in which she maintained the building. It was just horrific. Rats in the hallways, holes in the hallways, no heat, no air. It was just a disaster. And through a deal with the tenants and the court, Tenacity Group bought the building. And with the acquisition of the building, we had a development deal with the tenants. And that building was a wonderful example of where tenants were able to purchase at very low prices. Most of the tenants there, by the way, took a buyout of, I think it was like $50,000 a piece, which for them was exactly what they wanted. And the building today, the units in that building are selling in the mid-400s.
As you say, we've toured some of your projects in D.C., and it's amazing how diverse your owners are in the same building, obviously from different family incomes, a wide range of ages. How do you pull that mix off?
That's a very interesting question, and what we really have in a lot of our buildings are something equivalent of 7th Street meeting Wall Street. We have tenants that could be Section 8 welfare recipient tenants that are living in a building that gets converted, and we help them buy their unit, and they're buying their units in the $90,000 range. And when we go to market with the other half of those units, the other half of those units are actually selling to the marketplace for $400,000 or $500,000. And so you actually have, you know, people in the building that are there for for a tremendous amount of money, and people that are in there for almost nothing. Now, where it gets interesting is that there's a tenant association, but once the building is converted to condominium, it becomes a condominium association, and the different members of the board consist of these different individuals. Some are working at major national law firms, and others are truly welfare recipients. And that is a process, and it is a process of each of them learning from each other what's important. What, you know, typically the tenants that bought there have a certain set of wish list items, and the people that are purchasing at the market price have others. But we have never found in all of the buildings that the two groups couldn't find a way to get along. They just have to learn a little bit from each other.
What's the biggest conflict you've encountered between the two groups?
The biggest conflict that we would routinely see is where the People that have paid more money want more services in the building, or don't mind a higher condominium monthly fee because they can afford it. And so the tension that will exist is the tension whereby the welfare Section 8 type person is saying, no, listen, I was able to buy it because Massey Group gave us financing, or we were able to convert our Section 8 housing voucher into a home ownership payment, and so I can afford the unit. I can actually own the unit. But if you take a condo fee of $250 a month and now make it $450 a month, that by itself could end up pricing me out of the building. And so we have seen that tension before, but typically what happens is through reason and debate, they reach a middle ground.
Besides D.C., where else do you have projects?
We are very active in the Maryland area, in Virginia. We have been very active in Florida and active in California. But the D.C. area, and that is where that's where our company, our executive offices are based in Bethesda, Maryland, but we have a large D.C. office, is really our backyard, and that is where the vast, vast majority of our work has been done. We are contacted by local governments all the time to come in and speak to address the issue of workforce affordable housing and how it is to take some of their rental stock and convert it. At the same time, you have the zealots on the other side of the debate of workforce housing that really want low income rental. And a tension always exists between the two groups, those groups that believe in low-income rental and those groups that believe in creating workforce housing opportunities.
And tenants' rights laws are always key to your business, right?
The tenant right, by way of example, in the District of Columbia, the tenant right law, this TOPA law, is what gives the tenants the seat at the table, gives them the hook. The fact that the landowner has to deal with them when they go to sell the building gives the tenants the ability to negotiate both the opportunity to purchase the building as well as the opportunity to negotiate with the developer for the purpose of creating the home ownership opportunity. Because keep in mind that in the absence of a developer that's going to come in and do the initial financing of the acquisition cost and then the renovation cost and then the conversion cost and then ultimately helping the individuals finance their particular units, there's no way in which you can get to the tenants would be able to get to the end line on their own. They need assistance, and they need assistance from a developer. It doesn't have to be Tenacity Group, but they do need that assistance, because more often than not, I've never seen it the other way, that the tenants would have the resources or the knowledge base of how to get it done.
Eric, you've said that you look at Tenacity Group as the Walmart of the real estate industry. What do you have to be really good at doing to serve a low-end market and, as you say, leave no tenant behind?
You have to be consistent. You have to be consistent in your message. You have to be consistent in your contracts. You have to make sure that the individuals you're dealing with have adequate representation, have good lawyers that are representing them, so the deals that you negotiate with them, they understand them. What happens where deals get offline is where people don't understand what it is they have agreed to. They'll elect a tenant association. The tenant association will typically be the group of, you know, the small percentage of the people that are actually dealing with the attorney, and the attorney is typically the one that's dealing with the developer. We have found that when we are extremely consistent with the tenants and we make sure that they are clear on what is going to be done, what is their responsibility, what is our responsibility, we have found that those are the times where everything goes very smoothly. There are times where tenants are not as well informed. That's never the obligation of Tenacity Group, although we do as much as we can with fairs at the properties to make sure everybody's as educated as possible as to what is going on and what the deal is and what has been agreed to. But in the times where those tenants, the individual tenants, just are not clear as to what to expect, when they're not clear as to how the transition is going to occur, that's when sometimes tensions get a little high.
Eric, if you've figured out how to provide workforce housing, why can't the federal government figure this out?
I think that workforce housing is a practical solution, and it needs practical implementation. And I think what happens, especially with large bureaucracies, is they simply can't get out of their own way, and they don't move fast enough. And by the time things get funded from the initial seed funding, and then when you get to the place where you need to get the funding for the individuals that are purchasing their units, there's no developer that could actually wait that long and have that much carry on their building and be able to successfully complete a conversion. With the inability for the governmental groups to streamline their process, with their reluctance to do public-private partnerships to get to the finish line, with the political fear that is realized in many jurisdictions, which is, well, great, we'll help you all get to a place where you all are going to develop workforce housing for our constituents. And here's our problem. Our problem is that we have this other group out there that's screaming, as soon as they convert that building that was a rental, you have now taken rental stock, low-income rental stock, out of the marketplace. Now, yes, this low-income family may purchase a unit for $100,000, and that's great. That workforce housing family now owns something for $100,000. But when they sell it, they're going to sell it for $400,000 or $500,000. And so here's what's happened. It's only been one housing generation has had the benefit. The zealots that scream about low-income rental wanted to stay low-income rental, don't want the buildings converted because they want housing generation after housing generation to be able to benefit for the lower-priced rental stock. And that is a tension. We at least appreciate that there is another point of view in workforce or lower-income housing, be it ownership or rental. The problem is the zealots that represent the renters don't see it that way. They only see it their way. They don't believe that individuals should have the right to purchase their unit, to build equity, to have all of the benefits of homeownership, to have the ability to pay off their credit card debt, to have the ability to put their kids in college, to have the ability to one day have some form of a nest egg to retire. That's what we believe.
Eric Bolog is managing partner of Tenacity Group. City View's commentator Walker Smith says the problem with the roads we're building today is their speed. Too often, they bypass the regular pace of life.
My wife and I were whizzing along the interstate highway one afternoon when, without warning, we found ourselves at a dead stop at the end of a line of traffic that stretched ahead as far as we could see, and soon enough, as far back as well. We were traveling to visit some friends and to go to a show later that evening, so travel time and show time were on our minds. Traffic was making no time, however. An hour later, we'd gone less than 2 miles. At which point we decided that we'd be better off taking another route, so we pulled across the median and headed back. At the very first exit we came to, we got off and made 2 right turns to pull onto a county road that more or less paralleled the interstate. We couldn't drive at interstate speeds, but at least we were moving. In no time, though, we realized that we didn't want to zip down this road anyway, for there behind the billboards and foliage that wall off the interstate highway was a countryside bustling with life and community. In our many mad dashes up and down that interstate highway, my wife and I had never given much thought to what was there. We only knew the convenience stores and rest stops that crowd around each exit, and the brief time we spent at any of those places only left us with a dull, grimy feeling about what might be around the corner. Getting right back onto the interstate always seemed the prudent thing to do. But on this particular afternoon, getting off the interstate seemed to be our only option. We found ourselves on a road lined by wide expanses of rolling pasture land that gave way only as we would reach the outskirts of yet another picturesque small town. We drove by rambling 2-story farmhouses sitting at the edges of ponds or small lakes and engirdled with wraparound porches that were shaded by towering trees. A diner or two advertised home cooking. Yellow school buses were parked in neat rows in front of old brick school buildings. We passed pickup trucks and lumber yards and insurance agencies and small concrete block buildings and lots of other indicators of a thriving community filled with the day-to-day demands of work, home, family, and life. A busy, vigorous world hidden from view on the interstate highway corridor just around the corner. This is the sort of surprise awaiting us when we stop to have a look. Communities are underfoot everywhere. We think of certain places as lifeless, so to speak, but only because we haven't given them a closer look. In the cosmic sense, the late poet A.R. Ammons once chided us not to overlook the tenacity and pervasiveness of life in a poem of his called Bees Stopped. On a walk along a lakeshore, the poet finds life everywhere he stops, even in places we don't expect to find it, like plants taking root in rocks or wildlife scurrying about in dried-up grass. This confirmation that life is everywhere sends the poet on his way, whistling. Likewise, we build communities everywhere. Archaeologists have found evidence of human civilizations on every part of the planet, save Antarctica. Even in the very depths of vast wilderness areas like the Grand Canyon or the Amazon rainforest, scientists continue to find pervasive evidence of human habitation in every nook and cranny. And, they tell us, they have only scratched the surface of what is there to find. I was reminded that afternoon that my wife and I detoured off the interstate, that we tend to forget the ubiquity of communities in our hurry to get from one place to another. But in between, there is community too. When we fail to remember this, we start to treat other places as vacuums to be filled up with our own projects and desires. And when this becomes a habit of mind for everyone, then eventually we ourselves will wind up as the people forgotten by others in their plans to fill our communities with their projects and desires. Taking care not to forget, stopping to remember that life and communities are everywhere, is the starting point of empathy and respect. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders whose new report on America's portal neighborhoods can be found at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.